You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alex DeBoer. CITR's news collective reports to you weekly with alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
And I'm Joshua Azizi. It is Thursday, February 7th at 5:04 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamam-speaking Musqueam people.
That's right. And on today's show, we're going to hear an interview with New Westminster City Councillor Jamie McAvoy, who explains what a progressive new bylaw that the City of New West passed on Monday does to protect renters and why it could have a ripple effect to other municipalities.
And after that, we'll go to a conversation that News Collective member Kaylee Higgs had with the UBC Political Climate Action Group, UBC C350, who are running a campaign on campus which started this Monday and goes till February 13th, titled UBC Break Up with Fossil Fuels.
Yes, what a title. I think it ties in with Valentine's Day.
Clearly.
It goes right into Valentine's Day. Great. So first, we are going to go right to our piece on New West's new progressive renter protection policy and the interview that you, Josh, did with Jamie McAvoy. So here we go.
Yeah,
take a listen.
Next speaker, Angela Meredith.
Very nervous. Thank you for the council for allowing me to speak. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about how this has made my husband and I feel. We were served the runaway eviction notice on December 27th, and as John had mentioned, it was terrible. Coming right out of Christmas, going into the new year, thinking, knowing that we were being evicted and that we had to move, and we only had four months to do so. The issue that I'm having is right now we probably have about five suites in our building that are empty. If these renovations are going to be done, then why can they not be done now and allow us that are still there and fighting this once those are renovated to move into those renovated suites? I don't understand why we have to leave the home that my husband and I have lived in for 6 years. The landlord had, I believe, misrepresented himself in making a lot of us believe that he was the property management when in fact he was the owner, giving us false hopes as he was text messaging me, emailing me to help us out, apartments that he had found on Craigslist, which I then later found out they were his buildings, for more money. The apartment that we did see was horrendous. I had asked him if he had been in our apartment. He had seen how we lived and he wanted to show us this for $400 more. I don't believe a word that is coming out of this man's mouth. I don't believe that anything is going to, or the extent of the renovations are going to be done to the matter that we do all have to leave. I believe that these things can be done with tenants still living in their apartments. And I just hope that you can help us. It's very difficult. There's so many people in there, elderly people, disabled people, that now have nowhere to go, that are looking for places to go.
That was a tenant named Angela Meredith, who spoke in front of the New West City Council on Monday, February 4th. Following an emotional public hearing where renters and renter activists spoke out about a variety of fears and anxieties related to being a renter, New West City Council voted unanimously to pass a new bylaw. This new bylaw, which has been praised as the most progressive renter protection motion in BC, stops landlords from evicting tenants for the purpose of renovation and then increasing the rent once a new tenant moves in. According to the new bylaw, landlords who are caught continuing to use rent eviction strategies as a way of increasing profit by raising the rent an unreasonable amount could be fined up to $1,000 a day and could lose their business licenses. CITR News Collective member Joshua Azizi reached New West City Councillor Jamie McAvoy to discuss the importance of this bylaw and why it's the next best thing to vacancy control. Take a listen.
Hi, is this Jamie?
Yeah, hi.
Thank you for your time. So can you kind of start out by telling our listeners who you are?
My name is Jamie McAvoy. I'm a city councilor in New Westminster, where I'm also a co-chair of the Social Issues Committee and a member of the Mayor's Task Force on Housing.
All right. And so can you take me through how New Westminster has been affected by rent evictions in the past few years?
Well, in the past few years is a good way to put it. This is something that used to happen maybe once a year. Now it's more like a few times a month that people are buying an apartment looking to do this. So we've had, I'm not sure the time frame, but we've had about 369 units that have been rent evicted. And, you know, on average, those are a couple of people in a unit, so that's a lot of people.
And so there was a new bylaw passed by New West City Council on Monday, which allows the city to penalize landlords who rent evict tenants. Can you tell me how that bylaw works?
Yep, the bylaw was adopted as well as a rental program. So the way the bylaw works is that there's certain things set out where a landlord can be fined by the city if they rent evict and if they don't follow the rules of the Residential Tenancy Act. So there is provision in there for fines for failing to give people adequate notice. There's also provision in there for a fine for excessive increase of rent.
And so let's say there's a landlord who, despite these new rules, tries to rent evict someone anyways. This landlord would be faced with fines?
Well, if the landlord rent evicts without getting a building permit, then they're violating someone's rights under the Residential Tenancy Act, and they would be violating our bylaw, and they would get fined. If they needed a building permit, then they would have to come to the city of New Westminster, where we now have a policy that says you don't rent evict people if you need to do renovations. You would have to prove to us that the eviction was necessary in order to do the renovation. And given that most renovations are things like painting and countertop, but even some renovations that might involve plumbing, for example, we did a review where we looked at, do people move for other types of building permit? If people renovate a condo or a house? And we found that people almost never have to move in those circumstances, right? So, but if a landlord would have to come and get their building permit and they'd have to prove to us that an eviction was necessary, if they went ahead with an eviction without that, they would be fined. And if they evicted people to dramatically increase the rent on the unit, they would be fined.
And so under what conditions would it be acceptable for a landlord to temporarily evict a tenant for renovations?
That's something that we're still going to have to explore, but we're putting the burden on the landlord to provide that proof. The burden isn't on the tenant as it is provincially.
And would there be any provisions for renters who are temporarily evicted?
Yes, we want tenants to have the right of return.
Can you just tell me, just for our listeners, what the right of return is?
The right of return is if you have to move out because the renovations are such that the suite does have to be empty, you should have the right to return back to that suite if you want to. And a part of what we did here was we've introduced business licensing for landlords, right? I mean, it is a business. We all know it's a business, right? It's kind of bizarre that all around the world, you don't have business licenses for owning rental property. So when you have a business license, then the city is able to put conditions on that business license. And if a landlord was violating those conditions, we'd have to consider pulling their license, pulling their right to rent property as residentially.
And so from what I understand, the two possible punishments could be a fine or losing their business license. Under what situations would a landlord actually lose his or her business license in contrast to just getting a fine?
Yeah, that's something we're still going to have to explore.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so even if these future evictions happen, the landlords are not allowed to increase the rent, correct?
They're allowed to increase the rent, but they can't, you know, double the rent. They can't raise it 75%. They can't do the kind of thing they're doing now.
Is there like a set margin that they can increase it by?
No.
Okay.
No, we have not defined excessive yet. But I want to say something about that because we had a landlord come who complained about the 2% increase in rent that he's allowed and that he argued this doesn't keep up with inflation, right? Every time a unit is empty of a tenant, the landlord can increase the rent all they want. That's illegal, right? What we're targeting is evicting the tenant to do it. But when people try to represent this as a business that's somehow suffering under rent control, rent control is 2% last year, but the actual increase in rents went up 6.98%. Last thing was 6.2% this year. It was 5.98% last year. And that's because if a place becomes empty voluntarily, a tenant moves out, the landlord can increase that rent to market rates. So they have a pretty good mechanism already, right? They have a pretty good mechanism already for renovating 50% turnover in 3 years. Every time someone moves out of an apartment, that's when you can put in your new counter, right? So the rent increases where people are seeing rent doubled from $800 to $1,600, that's just not on.
Thank you for sharing that. And another thing that I wanted to ask about was the public hearing on Monday, mm-hmm. where a lot of rental advocates came out to tell their stories, as well mm-hmm. as tenants coming to tell their stories. What was it like to sit through that public hearing and hear all those personal testimonies?
Oh, it was painful. You know, I mean, the people in this town, I'm not just a politician. People are my friends, my own relatives who are renters, right? It's painful to sit through those stories. And I mean, there's a woman who didn't come to the public hearing who lost an $800 a month place, went to a $1,200 a month place. Her income is $1,300 a month. What do you do with that other $100? Will that feed you? You won't be taking any bus rides. You won't be buying presents for her grandchildren, you know. And who evicts an 83-year-old? Because they want to make more money off of her suite. So, you know, these kinds of things, it needs to be dealt with. And we're doing this to try to deal with it in New Westminster. And we really need the province to step up on this issue. And we need the federal government to get into housing again.
And how much of a role did these testimonies and the work of renters' rights advocates play in convincing council to pass these laws?
Oh, I think they played a huge role, not just at the public hearing, but the tenants have been getting more and more organized in Vancouver. There's a New Westminster Tenants Union that didn't exist even a couple of years ago. ACORN has held demonstrations outside of buildings that have been rent evicted. So I think they've done fantastic work to put this issue on the radar and make sure that we know about it.
And were you at all surprised by the result that came out of council?
No, I was not surprised. The only thing that surprised me was that the public hearing was overwhelmingly in support of this bylaw. I thought there might be some opposition to it. We had some opposition expressing concern from Landlords BC, for example, but the only landlord who spoke, he said there's no good reason to double the rent. He's never had a good reason to double the rent, and he wouldn't do that. So the only landlord who spoke in favor.
And I actually wanted to, you were talking about the province about a minute or so ago. I kind of wanted to circle back to that. So the bylaw that was just passed was celebrated by renters and renter advocacy groups alike, and it's pretty clearly like a win for tenants. But something that I noticed was that it didn't include any calls for the provincial government to implement any vacancy control, which would tie the rent of the unit to the unit rather than the renter. So I'm just wondering, why wasn't vacancy control a part of this bylaw?
Well, we don't have the jurisdiction in that area, but we have previously called for vacancy control, and we took a motion to the UBCM on that issue, and that's, you know, that's our position as a city.
Because I was just looking at the rent eviction motions, the rent eviction related motions that the Vancouver City Council passed, and there was one that it was tabled by Jean Swanson. She mm-hmm. asked the council to basically demand the province to implement vacancy control. Why wasn't something like this included in the bylaws?
Well, the bylaws are our legal mechanism to enforce fines and business licenses, but mm-hmm. but we've already called for vacancy control previously.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And yet the province still hasn't made any action on that. Why do you think vacancy control hasn't happened yet?
Well, I think that there's tremendous resistance to that on the part of landlords. I think that up until recently, landlords have been more organized than tenants. So that seems to be starting to shift, and every single tenant who gets involved or joins an organization is helping with that shift. But I'll admit to being somewhat flustered and frustrated about it, too. We are going to send the recording of the public hearing. We're going to send that to provincial officials and ask them to watch it.
And so is this bylaw kind of like the next best thing if getting vacancy control just seems too like out of reach at the moment?
It's as close as we thought we could get within the powers that we're allowed to use.
And so, correct me if I'm wrong, but is New Westminster the first city to pass bylaws such as these?
We think so. There was a reporter from another outlet who looked into it, and she thought that in Ontario there was some good rent eviction protection. But for a city to do it, really, I think we are the first.
And why do you think these rent eviction protections passed first in New West rather than, say, in Burnaby or Vancouver?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're pretty committed to people's rights in New Westminster, social and economic justice, and we have a very strong city council that cares about people, every member of council, and half of our population is renters in New Westminster. We have a much larger proportion of renters than most cities do. So it's really something that's on our consciousness as we govern the city.
And do you think these new bylaws could have an influence on other municipalities who are dealing with issues of rent eviction?
I sure hope so.
And that's actually the last of the questions that I had. Is there kind of anything else that you wanted to mention before we go?
I think that a lot of cities will look at what we've done, and I would leave it to them to say who they are, but I've had inquiries from other cities and other city councillors already. In fact, I'm meeting with a couple on Friday, and so there's a lot of interest in what we did here in New Westminster. People have felt really helpless on the issue of rent evictions because provincially we're not allowed to refuse the building permits. That's the law, and municipalities are operated only within the powers the province gives us. So people cared about the issue, but were very frustrated and felt like they couldn't do anything. And we started to have a discussion after the election here in New Westminster where we just said, is that true? Let's review all of our powers and see if we have anything that can apply. And what we came up with was business licensing, and it can be done anywhere.
You actually mentioned that you were meeting with city councillors from other cities.
Mm-hmm.
Which councillors are you meeting with from which cities?
I would leave it to them to tell you that.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye. Yeah.
Bye.
All right, and that was an interview done by News Collective member Joshua Azizi with New West City Councillor Jamie McAvoy. And we are going to take just a super quick break, and then we're going to hear from Joshua about some reporting he did yesterday for the UBC on SASC, UBC's Sexual Assault Center.
Sexual Assault Support Center.
Sorry, say that again.
Sorry, Sexual Assault Support Center.
Sorry, Sexual Assault Support Center, my mistake. And a new increase in student fees that was passed by the AMS, the Alma Mater Society.
It's a proposed fee increase. The fee increase has to be voted on by the students.
There we go.
And that will happen around March, sometime in March or February.
Cool. And that is why Joshua is the expert and I am merely inquiring. So we'll be back with more Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 in just a couple minutes. Please stay tuned. Here we go.
Are you a friend of ours who loves to get discounts? Come down to CITR, deals and you can count. We've partnered with some local businesses, so come down to us to get your card before it's too late.
As a member of CITR Discorder, you get amazing deals with some of Vancouver's finest local businesses, such as Devil Mayware, Audiopile, the Stormcrow Tavern and Ale House, the Biltmore, Book Warehouse, and Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium. For more information, visit citr.ca/friends.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakulia, Talitin, who Musqueam must stay. Let's see here.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh.
Everybody.
God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
All right, and we're back. Thanks for bearing with us. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name's Alex DeBoer, and I'm joined in studio with...
Joshua Azizi.
Right on. Why did I say that? It's okay.
Because you're just feeling conversational.
Apparently.
Okay.
That was... Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so anyway, we heard an interview that you, Joshua, did with New West City Councilor Jamie McAvoy about a new progressive renter protection act that passed in New West. And it was really interesting. We heard a bit about how, you know, Jamie thinks that maybe this new bylaw can have an effect on other municipalities, such as in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. He did mention as well that in New West, one of the reasons this bylaw might have passed there first rather than another municipality is because they have a high amount of renters, like 50% of their people living in New West are renters, but I'm pretty sure it's the same in Vancouver, isn't it?
I mean, I don't really know the statistics, but I'd imagine it would be.
I have to double check, but it's comparable, I believe. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether any of our city councilors in Vancouver kind of feel the heat and propose a similar motion. Mm-hmm. Because as you mentioned in your interview, you know, Gene Swanson did table a motion that was similar but focused more on vacancy control, and it was knocked down by council, whereas, well, the motion passed, but the sections of it that requested council ask the provincial government for vacancy control to be put in place, that was knocked out. Mm-hmm. Whereas New West has already done that. They've already agreed that they should be lobbying the provincial government for vacancy control, so... That's kind of interesting. They're clearly more progressive in renter rights.
So I guess I've been kind of like mostly looking into what happened with New West in the past few days. But
yeah,
I guess for our listeners, can you just remind us what were the rent eviction? Because I know that what were the rent eviction bylaws that Vancouver passed about a few months ago?
Yeah, that was in December, I think. We did an episode on it on Seeking Office. So some of our listeners may have heard it, but yeah, it was a motion. I think it was titled a motion on aggressive buyouts and rent evictions, something to end aggressive buyouts and rent evictions. So it passed that the city of Vancouver now has to look into ways to keep a database of buildings that are bought out and being redeveloped. And they have to inform tenants in these buildings, like if it's an apartment, of their rights as renters. And they also made it a little bit harder for people to rent-evict, which is what's most similar to this bill in New West. So basically now if there is a renovation that needs to take place and it's possible for people to relocate for a few months and then return, the renters then are allowed to return rather than being kicked out of their suite and having the suite offered to someone else for an increased rental fee. But the component of the motion, which Gene Swanson said was actually kind of the teeth of it, was a section that instructed city council to lobby the provincial government to implement vacancy control, which is when rent is tied to the unit rather than the person. And so that just did not pass.
Nope.
Very interesting. Anyway, so...
what is interesting, though, is that in New West, I mean, nothing about vacancy control was tied into what New West passed a few days ago, but the New West council has actually called on the government.
They've already called on it. Exactly.
I don't remember when exactly they did, but...
Yeah, I'd have to look into that, but yeah, they've already done that, so... It is interesting.
And it definitely seems like this, because this passed in New West, and this is something that I could definitely imagine coming up in the Vancouver Council again, too.
Right. And when Jamie said he'd been talking to some counselors, it's like, who are those counselors? I wonder.
We don't know. It's under wraps.
But yeah, it is really interesting because when people do, like, when councils pass progressive renter motions like this, like this bylaw, then, you know, we can say in Vancouver, hey, look what they did. Why aren't you doing this? Like, this is possible. And then it makes it a bit harder for Vancouver City Council to justify, you know, not having more aggressive renter protections. You know, like, how do they, you know, sell that to us as Vancouverites?
And, like, it would be interesting to see how this works in New West as kind of like a trial run for tougher bylaws against rent evictions. Because, like, I mean, a year from now, let's just say New West is the only municipality in Metro Vancouver that's done something like this. Other municipalities can look at it. And if it went really well, then who knows? Maybe we could see other municipalities adopt something like this.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully they don't wait that long. If this is something that is needed in places like Vancouver, which it is, I think it's pretty maybe not objective of me to say, but I think, you know, it is pretty clear that we need more aggressive renter protection. So, yeah. Anyway, I did want to talk about something else before we move on to our piece, the second piece in our series on climate change. Mm-hmm. The first piece of that series was an interview done by two of our News Collective members with Councillor Adrian Carr. And this time it's with the UBC social justice group, UBC C350, on a divest from fossil fuel campaign they currently are in the process of doing. Mm-hmm. Is that the verb? So before we get to that, in that interview, I wanted to talk to you, Joshua Azizi, about...
Hello.
Some reporting you did yesterday for the UBC on SASC, the Sexual Assault Support Center on UBC's campus, and some new funding they're looking for. How would you explain this?
Okay, so yeah, so something that I've been like reporting on for the UBC is like an upcoming referendum in this year's AMS elections. The AMS being the Alma Mater Society for University of British Columbia, the Student Union. If you want to use like high school terms, student government, quote unquote, basically. And the AMS, they own the Sexual Assault Support Center, which provides counseling services to survivors of sexual assault. And they also do like a lot of outreach work, like training clubs about like consent training and such. And they also run a program called Healthy Masculinities, where they just basically like they host like a men's circle where male identifying folks can come in to talk about masculinity, toxic masculinity, and how they kind of interact with those things in their daily life. And so students currently pay like a fee of $3.65. When this fee was implemented, it was actually a little bit lower because it's increased with inflation over time.
Right.
But when this fee was implemented, this was like a while ago. The SASC was a much smaller operation back then.
Right.
But kind of since all of that, the SASC has like dramatically grown over the years. They're doing a lot more training for clubs, where they'll like visit a club, teach them about consent, how to foster a healthy environment. And they have new programs and they have a lot more support workers.
And have they grown also as a result of like the Me Too movement?
They have much more increased
sort of
traffic
more reported,
these days.
Yeah, sexual assaults.
Survivors are definitely talking about that more and coming out with that, not wanting to hide it, and they're most definitely going to the SASC probably about that because they have seen increased traffic. And so they're running at full capacity, just a much more expensive operation than it used to be, but the fee has stayed the same. And so the AMS tried to raise the fee a year ago to $7 in a referendum question, But that referendum question was bunched in with a bunch of other changes, including one where like a dozen campus fees would have been subjected to renewal referendums every 3 years. So like, for instance, the Debate Society, if this fee restructuring package passed, mm-hmm. every 3 years, the Debate Society, their funding would be up for debate. I mean, their funding would be up for a referendum.
Would it be up for debate?
I see what you did there. Or it's actually what I did, but
it's actually what you did.
Yeah. So and there were a lot of kind of, I guess one could say, important clubs that would have been, that would have had their fees be up for regular renewal, like the Pride Collective, Color Connected Against Racism.
At least CITR.
Was CITR one of them?
We're a society.
I'm not sure if CITR was one of them. I don't know. It was a while I was looking back at that.
Honestly,
but
I should know. Mm-hmm. There are people at the station who know, and that's what matters.
Anyways, yeah, those clubs didn't like that. There was a campaign against it. And at the same time, the changes to the fees was also bundled in with doubling the SASC fee to improve the SASC. And yeah, so it was kind of – I remember interviewing Reed Marcus from the Debate Society at the time. And he was kind of like saying it was like, I think his term was hostage situation. I'm not really sure. I say that quote unquote. And so, yeah, there was kind of a lot of opposition to it. It didn't reach quorum. And so they're running it again with the higher fee. And just because like costs have grown and such. And they're really hoping that it can pass this time.
So this quorum, so a certain amount of students at UBC have to come out and vote.
A certain amount of students at UBC have to come out and vote yes to it, I believe.
They have to physically go, or can they vote like online?
Oh, yeah, you can just vote online.
Oh, okay, cool. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they're just, everyone I've talked to is like very confident that it will pass on, that it will pass because like students are very supportive towards this ask.
Okay.
But whenever like the talk about it not passing comes up, they seem to, how do I put it? They talk about running another referendum again if it doesn't pass. So they're a little stuck if it doesn't pass, but they seem pretty confident
that it will. Okay, last night the AMS, UBC's student government, voted to put to the student body a vote on whether the fee students pay into the sexual assault support center should be raised in order to have more resources for the center. Is that correct?
Yeah, they voted to put that they voted to put that fee increase in the upcoming AMS election referendum.
Okay, right.
And they also voted to say yes, that they were going to be like running in support of a yes vote for it.
Okay, so the government endorses it. The AMS government.
They endorse it, and they're also running a campaign in support of it. So you're going to see the promotional materials.
Right.
All over campus.
So that was kind of like the drama last night was like, will the AMS support this motion?
Is
that correct?
From what I remember of the people who were voting on it, it was almost unanimous. There was only one person who abstained and everyone else was voting in support of it at the AMS.
Okay. Well, one thing I think of when I hear this story is that I know at CITR, a big part of our funding comes from student fees as well. Mm-hmm. But people can opt out of it. Students can opt out of it. So I'm wondering, like, once – if this passes, if the referendum – is it a – that's right?
Yeah,
like if
referendum.
If the referendum if the results are that the fee should be increased, I wonder how that'll be advertised to students and if it will. Because if it's advertised widely, I could see people opting out. Because I know a lot of people opt out of CITR, even though we're really, really awesome and important.
Clearly.
Yeah. But do you know, you might not know about that, but do you know how increases in student fees are actually advertised or communicated to the student body?
I mean, they run promotions every year during AMS election season. Like, hey, these referenda are going on. These are what we're running on. We're increasing this. We're increasing this. And you should vote yes to them. And they generally pass most of the time. They pass.
Yeah.
And I should also note that they're like very small increases. Pretty much just kind of technical things. Usually, like if the UPass, the agreement that the university has with TransLink expires for the UPass, then they have to like renew it and such. So it's usually just small things like that. This is, I mean, it's only like a $5-6 increase, but it is kind of a big jump in this ask fee.
Yeah. Well, with all the students on campus, that results in a lot more money for this ask. So
They haven't really talked much about, like, oh, could students opt out? And it's not really something I've asked about yet, but it's, yeah.
Well, no. Can't students opt out?
Oh, yeah, they can.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's just not something that I've asked anyone about.
Right, right. I see what you're saying. Cool. Sweet. Well, did you want to add anything about that before I go to the next piece? We'll stay tuned for, obviously, your story in the UBC.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah, no, I think I'm okay. Yeah, we're good.
Cool. Yeah, so yeah, that's Joshua Azizi. So check out his work in the UBC.
Thank you, Alex.
No worries. You know, professional plugs for News Collective members. Cool. So once again, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to go to a climate change piece that was done by News Collective member Kaylee Higgs, who is not in the studio at the moment. She was going to come here, but I think isn't able to make it. So I'm just going to introduce this piece for you right now. Last week, we were fortunate enough to have City Councilor Adrian Carr on the show to talk about recent climate change emergency status that the City of Vancouver voted on and passed. And during that interview, which was done by Kaylee and Andy Laidman, Carr talked about the potential for cities to be leaders in the climate movement, like in the context of Canada as a whole. And she also talked about the importance of collaboration when it comes to climate justice. So at the end of the interview, Carr suggested for students, universities such as UBC, where, of course, CITR is located, for folks to get more involved, students to get more involved, citizens to get more involved. And this week, Kaylee followed up on this theme of climate action and cities as leaders and spoke to a couple students at UBC named Kate and Mika, who are involved with the UBC Environmental Justice Organization, UBC C350. So Kaylee wanted me to let you know Kaylee is a white settler and a member of the News Collective, and she recorded this conversation on the importance of collaboration and collective action when it comes to climate change, and especially what Mika and Kate of UBC C350 have to be hopeful about when it comes to this topic that, you know, can so often be really depressing and really deflating. So let's go to this interview now, and we will hear from Kaylee and Mika of UBC C350. Here,
doing a major in First Nations and Indigenous Studies. And I'm a fourth-generation settler born on the unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. I'm really lucky to have grown up here, and I think that whenever we're entering into these conversations about climate justice, it's really important to ground ourselves in where we're from and the fact that we are continuing to organize on land that was taken and that does not belong to us.
Hi, I'm Mika. I'm also a fourth-year UBC student. I study geography in the Environment and Sustainability program, and I am born to Japanese immigrant parents here in Vancouver.
So you're both involved with UBC C350 as well. Could you tell me and our listeners a bit more about what UBC C350 is?
Sure, I'd love to. So UBC C350 is a climate advocacy group here on campus, and we just try to create political action and pressures on climate action.
One of the things that I hear a lot about with UBC C350 as well is divestment. Can you speak at all to that or what that is?
For sure. So divestment is a campaign that was really the touchstone of UBC C350. It's been around for as long as we've existed. And divestment is essentially a political tactic that has been used throughout history as a way of taking away the social license of industries that are doing really shitty things in the world. So, for example, South African apartheid was met with a divestment campaign that had global reach that led to churches and universities and different institutions pulling their money out of industries that were supporting the apartheid regime. And what we're doing right now is a new iteration of that campaign that has to do with calling for institutions like UBC to pull their money out of the fossil fuel industry. Because right now, the University of British Columbia has about $85 million in its endowment fund that's directly supporting oil, coal, and gas. And we feel that that exists in blatant disregard of its stated goals of being a sustainable school and also of its mandate to be an institution that prepares us for a future, because we just don't believe that we're going to have a future if we're not taking immediate action on climate change, and our university needs to be a leader for us there.
Wow, yeah, that's a huge amount, and I didn't realize that that was the case. So what is UBC C350 working on right now then? Is that the main thing you're working on, or do you have a number of other things you're doing?
We have a couple projects going on right now, but right now, because it's February and it's Valentine's Day month, I guess, we are running this campaign called Breaking Up with Big Oil, going under our divestment campaign. And basically, we're trying to highlight the fact that UBC is in this toxic relationship with big oil companies and the fossil fuel industry. And we are trying to apply pressure to them in a friendly manner by highlighting the fact that their relationship is toxic, not only to them, but to those around them and the entire planet as well.
Great, thank you. So last week we were fortunate to have Adrian Carr on the show sharing thoughts on the recent motion that the Vancouver City Council passed to declare a climate emergency. One of the things that stood out to me from that conversation was her thoughts on cities being leaders in the climate movement. And you were just mentioning universities as well. And I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on the role that universities should play in this, and if they should be playing a similar role as climate leaders, or what roles do or should they play?
Yeah, that is such an interesting question, because in a lot of ways, universities and UBC in particular situates itself as a space for social innovation and political innovation, and it frames itself as a place that's pushing the agenda on a lot of these on a lot of the issues that we're dealing with in our world today. But in a lot of ways, our university is also very much linked to big money, and is very much influenced by the will of industries like big oil. So it's an interesting contradiction, because universities like this one are publicly funded, and they are meant to be preparing people for, you know, for a safe and livable and prosperous future. But at the same time, they're all wrapped up in these investments that are doing the opposite. So it's a really interesting question when it gets down to what a university's responsibility is to get political. And I fundamentally believe, especially because UBC is a public university, that it has this responsibility to be rising to meet the challenges of today. And we're seeing, you know, we're seeing this leadership from the University of British Columbia in some ways and not in others. But we're also seeing really bold leadership coming from cities like Vancouver declaring a state of climate emergency. We're seeing cities like London and New York divesting from fossil fuels. We're seeing countries like Ireland divesting from fossil fuels. And everywhere we're seeing all these institutions that are standing up and taking bold action. So especially in this moment of urgency around climate change, where we have an IPCC report that's told us we have 12 years to mitigate catastrophic climate change, there's no good reason why a university should remain apolitical. And I think when it comes to divestment, that's often the tack that this institution in particular has been taking.
So you're mentioning the role that universities might play in this, and maybe historically haven't been, but are more and more with some of the movements such as yours are hopefully taking that lead. Along those lines of looking at these other cities and other universities, how does the UBC divestment movement and UBC C350 fit into other movements across the country or on other campuses? Have there been leadership from other campuses and communities, or is this quite based here?
So one of my favorite things about the fossil fuel divestment campaign is it is global, and it has momentum at a lot of different universities across Canada and the States. And actually, the current campaign that we're working on, which is called UBC Break Up with Big Oil, is a campaign that's also been picked up by Dalhousie University and McGill University. And our friends over at UVic have launched a similar campaign calling for UBC to break up with fossil fuels. So one of the cool things about this kind of campaign is that it is very much not siloed. And there's a really strong solidarity movement of folks who are fighting for the same thing.
Sounds like it's part of quite a broader movement, and you mentioned its connections to divestment campaigns that happened during apartheid. Can you speak at all to the history of the movement? and the collaboration that is a part of it in the present as well as the past?
Oh, that's such a good question. And, I'm such a nerd about divestment because I really do think that it has so much potential to challenge the social license of industries that are behaving badly and to issue a strong challenge to the capitalist frameworks that are upholding climate change. Divestment in particular is a really interesting way of going about changing something because it is attacking industry where it most matters, which is, you know, the pocketbook. And one of the things that we're encountering with divestment is that, you know, you could talk about it just in terms of the finances and, you know, how much do we have to hurt the fossil fuel industry in order to have an impact. I think when we look at divestment, it's really important to remember that this isn't just a financial tool. This isn't just about influencing, the facts and the figures. But divestment is very tightly linked to on-the-ground violence that is happening right now, even in British Columbia. The University of British Columbia has investments in the Trans Mountain Pipeline. It has investments in Kinder Morgan and Coastal GasLink and other industries that are violating the rights of Indigenous peoples right here in British Columbia by forcing pipelines through territories where consent has not been given. And it's really important that we ground our divestment campaign in that knowledge, in the fact that this isn't just about fighting some abstract industry, but it is about challenging an institution that is allowing these instances of colonial and extractive violence to continue unchecked.
Thank you for bringing that up. And that actually really fits into something that we were talking about last week and that I wanted to ask you about as well, which you mentioned at the beginning, considering our location on unceded Musqueam lands here and on unceded lands throughout the lower mainland or the region currently called Vancouver. I wanted to ask you about if there are any specific collaboration with the Musqueam First Nation here for UBC C350 or other Indigenous groups on campus and how you bring that collaboration into this movement as well.
Yeah, there's been an ongoing issue within the environmental and the climate movement where there has been a siloing of folks who are on the ground doing frontline work against climate change and white organizers who are far removed from the effects of climate change, who tend to take up a lot of leadership roles within those climate spaces. And I'm approaching this conversation as someone who has taken up one of those leadership spaces in a climate movement as a white person, and I'm cognizant of that dynamic. There's a lot of work to be done, for sure. And we're invested in figuring out how our divestment movements and how our other movements can be supporting the efforts of frontline folks who are doing a lot of the important work on the ground to fight climate change and resist colonial and extractive industry. But I think in all of our organizing, we do have a long way to go.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that recognition, too, that there's always this an ongoing process and still ways to go always. So along those lines of looking at the broader community, how does UBC C350 extend beyond the campus? What are its impacts and relations beyond the UBC community, especially considering CITR is broadcasting to all of the Lower Mainland and UBC is technically provincial, not a part of Vancouver. So yeah, wondering if you can address the relationship between UBC C350 and the broader community, either through its impacts or its relationships.
Yeah, I mean, the climate movement is broad and evolving, and I think it's also really good at building networks of solidarity. So UBC C350, for example, collaborates with 350 Vancouver, collaborates with other frontline movements in Vancouver that are doing important work, and we're constantly reaching beyond this campus to expand that impact. We've done a lot of federal election work where we've just been out in the community doing the thing, and we've tapped into movements against the Trans Mountain Pipeline and other similar fossil fuel infrastructure projects, and supported the work that's being done in the broader Vancouver community. And I think that that's really important, too, to remember that we're not siloed, that even out in this little bubble of a campus, beyond the reach of Vancouver, there's a lot of good work being done and a lot of cross-pollination, which is really exciting to me.
Great, thank you. So thinking back to last week when the emergency climate motion recently passed, what would you say the impacts are of grassroots organizing or organizations such as UBC C350 in climate action from governments, especially like I'm thinking especially colonial governments such as municipal, federal, and provincial? What role do they play and what role should these kinds of organizations play?
I think that there's been this myth that's been perpetuated about the way that we need to address climate change, and a lot of the narrative around this movement has to do with encouraging people to change their behaviors to be more in line with, a sustainable way of living. But what that analysis really fails to dig into is the fact that institutions like our governments and corporations have an immense amount of power and are very invested in maintaining the status quo. The reason that we haven't had action on climate change is because governments and corporations are actively blocking it, not because we're using too many plastic straws. And so the reason that this grassroots work is so important is because it is challenging power and forcing those decision makers who have been actively fighting climate action to take accountability for their actions. And that's only going to come when we have a mass mobilization of grassroots people who are forcing their hand. We elect governments that are more progressive as a form of harm reduction, not assuming that they are going to be the champions we need, because we're the champions that we need, and we're only going to see effective change when we're the ones that are pushing the agenda and pushing them to go further and to remain accountable to the promises that they've made us.
Along those lines, actually, I wanted to ask you, what role do you see students and citizens in general playing in creating climate action, especially you mentioned collective action in this regard?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think what decision makers often forget or gloss over is we have to carry the burdens and the implications of the decisions that they make. And so I think the power that students carry is really immense in creating collective action, in the sense that a large majority of us are quite young and we are educated, and we're trying to leverage our power and our privilege that we are actively working on to invite others, I guess, to join us in this movement in creating the change that we have to see going forward if we want to have a future for ourselves.
Thank you. Along those lines of a future and future opportunities, I wanted to ask you both, I know there's often a lot of doom and gloom sometimes around climate justice and climate action. And I wanted to ask you both, what gives you hope?
I love this question because I have no hesitation in my answer that it's really the community, and that's really what UBC C350 has given me. And I personally had a lot of struggle joining the environmental movement because I just didn't really see what I could do and couldn't really understand what kind of space there was in the movement for myself. But what UBC C350 has really highlighted for me is that everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses, and there is room for all different sorts of skills and strengths and weaknesses within the movement. And if you don't really feel like you know yourself well enough to know what kind of skills you can use, that's something that we can always work together to figure out as a collective or a community.
Thank you. Did you want to add anything to that as well, for what gives you hope?
No, I think I really just want to echo what Mika said, because there's nothing more disempowering than trying to create change in a silo, and being able to tap into a community of people who are feeling the urgency and the fear of climate change just as much as you are, but who are willing to step up and do the thing alongside you, that just feels so good. It just feels so good to know that you're not on your own in this fight, because you can just draw on each other. It's also super fun. It's also just super fun to be part of a community of people who care.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So I think that's most of the questions that I had for you. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know, or that you feel like I should ask at this point?
I guess I'd just like to plug that we have a couple actions coming up this week. Because we're in the middle of this campaign, hashtag breakup with big oil, we're asking folks to help us get out the word by using the hashtag on social media, posting photos of them writing Valentines to the UBC Board of Governors, which is the institution that makes decisions about whether or not we divest. This coming Wednesday, we're going to be having an aerial photo shoot outside the nest, and we're going to get a whole lot of bodies together and take some rad photos of us spelling out divestment slogans. So if you want to come out and hang out and listen to some really angsty breakup music and help send our university a message that, you know, they need to be taking real leadership on climate change, please come. It's outside the nest. It's at 11:30. Yeah, and if you are looking for a community of changemakers to get radical and organized with, UBC C350 has its weekly meetings in the resource lounge of the Nest from 6 to 7 on Wednesdays. And we're always welcome to having new folks come in, and we would love to see you there.
Great. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. That was an interview conducted by News Collective member Kaylee Higgs. Kaylee interviewed Kate and Mika of the environmental justice group UBC C350. You heard some info at the end there if you want to get involved with them. Thank you so much for tuning into Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We will be back as usual next Thursday at 5 p.m. with more news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Also, please subscribe to our podcast, Seeking Office. You can find it pretty much everywhere you get your podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. And also, if you want to rate it 5 stars, that would be cool. Yeah, we will have a new episode, and by we, I mean me, because I'll probably be here late podcasting it. We'll have a new episode up tonight. So if you missed our interview with Jamie McAvoy of the New West City Council, you can find that in podcast format tonight. So that's it. My name's Alex DeBoer. Thanks again for listening. Up next on CITR is No Dead Air, so please stay tuned for that. Thanks again. Bye-bye.